Welcome back to the Pianofortissimo podcast, episode number 13. I'm your host, Alexandra Silocha, and today we're stepping into music theater and stage directing with a guest whose visionary work has redefined storytelling on stage. My guest today is the wonderful Irish stage director Sinéad O'Neill. Known for her distinctive movement and dynamic musicality, Sinéad's approach to directing opera and music theater is nothing short of transformative. Whether she's collaborating with one performer or 100, her work leaves an indelible mark on audiences. Sinéad's career spans original music theatre and repertory opera, with projects ranging from world premieres to revivals of timeless classics. She's currently directing the world premiere of Jonathan Dove and April de Angelis' new opera, Uprising, at Glyndebourne, an exciting testament to her ability to bring new works to life. But her creative journey goes far beyond the traditional opera house. Sinéad has co-created groundbreaking works like The Raven and London Burned and Amor Mundi with composer Matt Rogers. She also founded Cambridge City Opera to introduce innovative music theatre to new audiences and has spearheaded youth projects like Pay the Piper for Glyndebourne. During the pandemic, Sinéad O'Neill created Precipice, a site-specific performance that combined opera, dance, circus and spoken word in a hauntingly original promenade experience. Her work has been celebrated for its boldness, its beauty and its profound impact. In this episode, we'll dive into Sinéad's creative process, and it's also the first time when a guest is challenging me with some questions. Welcome to Piano Fortissimo, the podcast where the world of classical music meets personal stories and professional insights. I'm your host, Alexandra Silocha, concert pianist and bossa nova artist for over two decades. Join me as we explore the intricacies of music careers, the artistry behind pianos and other instruments, dive deep with special guests from all corners of the arts, and uncover the nuances of cultural and self-management. Whether you're an aspiring musician, a performer, or simply a music lover, this podcast offers something for everyone. Dear Sinéad, it's a pleasure to have you with us today on the Piano Fortissimo podcast. I cannot wait to start the conversation with you.
Good morning. Well, it's a pleasure to be here.
Sinéad, what inspired you to pursue a career in opera and how has your journey evolved over time?
Oh my goodness, it's such a big question, but it's such a fun question because, like many people, I had absolutely no idea what I wanted to do with my life when I finished university. And it's a funny one because when I started university, I was very sure about what I wanted to do. And over the course of the few years, I sort of lost that certainty. So when I started, I studied music and French at university and I wanted to be a musician. But I found the study of music intellectually and the study of language and culture so exciting that it's also I wasn't a good enough musician. Right. Let's be honest. That the combination of those two realizations sort of led me away from wanting to be a musician, but I didn't know what it led me towards, so I wasn't sure what I did want to do. So like many people, I had to sit with that uncertainty, and I was working after I finished university in a box office. Now, working in a box office, have you ever worked in a box office?
No.
Well, okay, you learn a lot about your audience, let me tell you. I've worked in three organizations in box offices, and you do learn a lot about how people behave when they think the person they're talking to is not very important. So I was working in the box office. It's true. I was working in the box office of the National Concert Hall, where I don't mind saying the National Concert Hall in Dublin. I mean, I don't mind saying that the audience were very rude. But again, you do learn a lot about people when you're faced with such situations. So anyway, there was an ad on the staff notice board for an internship at Wexford Opera Festival. Mm-hmm. Which is a small opera festival in the southeast of Ireland. And I thought, oh, well, I'm quite interested in opera from my studies. And I'd been to the opera once or twice and it never really did anything for me. I didn't think it was very, very exciting. But I thought, well, I need something to do. I will apply. And I went to Wexford to do this internship. And It completely changed my life. I mean, it was just, just a revelatory experience. The very first of all, I met a lot of Italians, which was great. It was very exciting, and I still have a soft spot for Italians. And secondly, I got to be in the room when people were singing. And I remember the first rehearsal I was ever in, and I was just sitting there. Didn't have any role to play. I was just there to observe and take it all in and learn. And I was sitting there, and it was just a damp, cold church hall in the middle of Wexford town. And then these people just started singing, and I couldn't believe the raw emotion, the power, the directness, the primal quality of this human voice at its most open and its most free. And it just completely blew me away. And it was like a light bulb. I thought, I just have to, this is what I have to do. This is what I have to do. So that's where it all began, many, many, many years ago.
So why didn't you become a singer? Because if opera
All
was
very well. I mean, that's all very well to say, why didn't you become a singer? Well, will I sing something for you now, and you can find out why I didn't become a singer? No, I had no interest in being a singer, and actually, I would find it, not that I can sing, so it's an academic question, but I would find it very terrifying. It's really such a, you're so open. All you've got is your body when you're a singer, and everything comes from your body. It's very, I have the greatest respect for singers, and I love working with
But
singers.
then, how did you become a stage director?
That's exactly the question, because I had absolutely no idea how to do it. So when I was in Wexford that very first time, I made it my business to go to all the rehearsals I could, and they were rehearsing at the time six operas. So I sort of rotated, and I went to all six rehearsal rooms in rotation. So I immediately got to see six directors working, and just felt that that was what I wanted to do. That I felt that that was the storytelling, the communication, the finding the pictures in the music. I felt that was what I always, that was it. That was what I was. That was what I wanted to do. But I had absolutely no idea what the pathway might be to become a director. No idea. And for some reason, it didn't occur to me to ask anybody. I didn't have an awareness of that there was even a pathway, a known pathway. I just sort of thought, well, I just have to figure this out for myself. And that's a life lesson, isn't it? I have often felt that. I felt, oh, this is just something I have to figure out on my own. And in fact, it's not really, is it? Like, there's loads of people you could ask, and they could help you and support you. But I didn't really think about that. For some reason, that didn't occur to me. So what I thought to myself was, I need to learn as much about this art form as possible. And in order to do that, I need to be in the rehearsal room as much as possible. So what's the shortest route I can take to get into the rehearsal room? And I thought, well, to continue what I'm actually doing, which was sort of helping out a little bit in the rehearsal room. So I kind of persuaded the people I was working with in the stage management teams to take me on as a sort of helper. And I kind of helped out a bit. And because they were working in opera, they sort of took me on as like a junior assistant stage manager type of person. So I could sweep the stage, or I could make a few props, or I could do a bit of shopping, or I could whatever it needed to be done, right? Within my head, I had all the time, well, I can be observing all these rehearsal processes and seeing how a lot of different directors work and taking it all in.
But this was after your studies.
This was
So you're
after.
not a student anymore.
No, I'm not a student anymore. This was after my studies. And I worked in theatre. I did whatever at the time, whatever job I could get. I worked as a junior stage manager. I became a bit more senior. I worked as a deputy stage manager, where you're calling the cues of the show and sort of driving the show in a way. And that was great fun. And I met lots of people, and I learned lots of things. But of course, you can't then go to someone and say, well, look, I've been in a lot of rehearsal rooms. Please, can I direct a show? Because that isn't the pathway, actually, as it happens. I thought that that would be a pathway, but in fact, probably really isn't. So I still had quite a transition to make. So along the way, I had also done a master's in Oxford. I did a master's in musicology, where again, I just wanted to know all about opera. So I studied as much as I could about with opera scholars at that time. And that was a good thing to have in my back pocket because I was then able to apply to do a PhD when I saw one advertised at Glyndebourne. They were advertising for somebody to come and do research in their archives, and to sort of write the story, part of their story. And so I applied to that and got that. And that was great because it was a foot in the door at Glyndebourne. And again, I sort of used it to get to know everyone and go to rehearsals and, learn as much as I could. And when
I
they
remember that time.
you remember that time, and I met you and I met your husband, and used that to get to know the people at Glyndebourne, and then to go to them at the end of my time and say, look, can you take me on as an assistant director? Well, then that was my step into being an assistant director, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, but this for me, as in all this music directions, that's such a complicated path.
I know.
And an unsure one where you really never know how it will, if it will develop, how and in which direction.
Well,
But
it felt like that at the time, that's for sure.
yeah. But Sinead, what does a stage director in opera actually do?
Well, I can tell you now, having experienced many, many, many directors, that it's as varied as people are varied. So every director is completely different from every other one. And some are very, shall we say, insistent or dictatorial, or they say, this is what I want and this is what you do. And others are more exploratory, and some are very playful, and some are very serious, and it's sort of very dependent on the personality of the person. But for me, I think of it as being one part psychotherapist, one part midwife, one part artist, and one part leader. So if you mix all those things together, of course you're responsible for the vision of a production and the storytelling of the production. But you're also responsible for bringing into the world the artistry of your collaborators, of your singers and designers. And you're responsible for enabling the people you work with to be open artistically and to sort of express themselves and be, I think open is the best way of putting it, to finding a way that your artists that you're working with can be open, and you can really see them. Because what I'm interested in when I go to see someone perform is I want to see them. And most of the time we're hiding in some way.
Can you see if you're seeing a production where you're not involved then, can you have a feeling of if the artists are not themselves or if they're not feeling well? Can you feel that they're making everything they're supposed to do because the stage director is pushing them, or is there a fine line between this, or it's not possible to feel?
I think it's possible to feel, but I would put it the other way. I think you can feel it when it's truthful, right? You can feel it when it, and I put it the other way because it's probably less usual to have a really electrifying, open, touching performance. You might see a lot of performances before you see one that really you're going to remember for the rest of your life. But those ones that you will remember on your deathbed because they touched you so deeply, those are the ones that you really remember. I don't really know what the secret is to those performances. When I think in my head, I think, oh gosh, that time I saw him do that. I don't really know what the secret is, but what I feel is that it's something about being completely open and honest about a particular emotional state.
And how is it, for example, if let's say the dress rehearsal is absolutely amazing and you think this will be just fabulous, and then the premiere comes and something is missing, what do you do afterwards?
Well, that's very often the case, as we know, right? That's very often the case. And you put your finger on something because one of the component parts that you don't have in rehearsal is the audience. We would often have a dress rehearsal with an audience. Suddenly you've got an audience, but the dress rehearsal audience is very friendly because it's all work with and the people who love you. And the dress rehearsal audience wants the whole thing to be beautiful and gorgeous and funny. And especially if it's a comedy, the dress rehearsal audience will often laugh a lot. And the first night audience mightn't laugh at all. And that is really hard to deal with. That's very difficult to deal with. But what it shows us is that the audience actually is bringing something. And in fact, none of us can control that part of it. You kind of have to just sit with that and do your best. And the audience has to meet you, right? But in terms of what you can do, I think you can, as a director, you can encourage and support the performers to remember what you rehearsed and how it went in the dress rehearsal, and trust that, because the danger in getting a first night audience that doesn't respond is that the performers then really push because they're looking for that response, and they kind of get a bit panicked and get a bit stiff. And so trying to encourage them to relax and remember that it does work, and to sort of say, well, yes, it does work. What we did does work, and remember the dress rehearsal audience responded, and we need to trust it. We need to relax. And the audience will sometimes come and sometimes it won't come.
I'd love to see your notebook or something, how you note everything. Do you like write every movement somebody is supposed to do, and that one is coming, that one is reacting? How does it look like?
You mean the score?
Well, I don't know, how do you call it? Where do you write everything? Do you write it in a score, or do you have a separate book for the stage directing?
Yeah, no, you're right in the score. So, having worked for many years as an assistant director, one of the roles of the assistant is to notate everything. So that when, there's 50 people in the chorus and then they go and rehearse something else, they come back to you a week later and they can't necessarily remember.
Yeah,
You
so how?
have a note of what 50 people were doing at different times. So it's really fun. I really enjoy that, making a sort of
Plan.
a notation language for a score. So yeah, I did a combination. Everyone does it differently. Again, you can look at assistant director scores and everyone's will be different. But yeah, it's a combination of little stick figures, little drawings of people in a gesture, and
I'd love to see it.
arrows and it, or it's like, or choreography. There's always very interesting ways of notating choreography. So everyone finds their own way. But then going into the room as a director, you're not going to be sitting there writing things down as it happens. So what I tend to do is I might have some plans in my score, but again, you're not sitting in the rehearsal room looking at your score as a director. So the score is really for the planning. I would make a few notes and maybe a few pictures in my score, but then once I'm in the room, that I'd be just responding to whatever is in front of me and
So
working.
you have to note it afterwards, everything.
So either you have to notate afterwards everything, or you accept that you're going to forget it all, or you have somebody else notate it. Yeah, those are the options.
It's not being filmed, for example.
Look, people, I always forget about filming. But yes, people very often do film something for memory, so that they, so we can say, well, look, next time we come back, we can watch it back.
Yeah, it's also a lot of time.
I'm kind of, it takes a lot of time to then watch it, and then I definitely don't want the performers to watch it, because what you don't want is a performer looking at it going, oh God, and becoming self-conscious about what they're doing. So I'm a little bit cautious about it as a tool, because I think it's probably more useful to have the notation and then to step through together in a process of remembering together. Because as you're remembering, you're going to find new things. Whereas if you filmed it and then you're trying to reproduce what you did the last day from a film, it loses a little bit of that spark of the. It has its point. It has its uses. It definitely has its uses. For example, it's very useful if you're rehearsing the understudies, because then the understudy really does have to know exactly what the person did and do exactly the same thing. So there, a film is very useful.
Can you tell us what an understudy is?
Yeah, so not everybody has the luxury of an understudy, but in an ideal world, there would be an understudy for any solo role in an opera, so that if the main singer is sick or they can't perform for some reason, there's somebody who can step into the role who already knows the production. And of course, very, that's expensive to have. So very often there isn't such a person, and the performer who has to step into the role doesn't know the production, and that's a bit of a panic for everyone.
So it was like a double cast
It's a double cast.
if something happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Could you walk us through your process when preparing to direct a new opera production, and how do you approach collaborations with performers, designers, and composers?
Okay, so process. I mean, where it's available, I love to start the process by listening to the music. Now, it's only available to do that if it's not a new commission, right? Because if the new commission, you might find that you're going into the rehearsal room and you've never heard a note of music, and that is very exciting, and I really like that. But if the music is available to listen to, then that would be my starting point. And I suppose what I try to do is, and of course, as you know, there are a lot of different recordings, so you've got to choose which recording you're going to use as your starting point, right? But let's say you've chosen a recording that sort of resonates. I try and get into a sort of meditative state and listening to it without any kind of judgment or preconceptions and see what images come to mind.
Mm-hmm.
So not even necessarily very tied to the story, like I suppose a psychoanalytic approach maybe in that I just want to see what images float to the surface of my mind when that music plays. And it might be a flock of geese, or it might be, you know, it might be related to the story. And then I take those images and do a sort of, yeah, do a free following and just see where that takes me, you know. I just might write down a few words or a few pictures or walk around and see what things resonate. I'm just trying to find those things that really resonate with the music and take it from there really, and then build up a sort of visual world and a world of feelings. And I would take that world to the collaborators, which would be the designers and the conductor, and share it, and then we sort of pool our thoughts and see where it would take us really.
Does it then become a like a collaborational work, or is it your vision and then they have to move, go along with that?
I think it could be either, and it depends. I've done both. I sometimes I have had a really strong feeling and I said, this is what it's going to be. Can you please design me you know, an archway and three doors here and two doors there, and very, very prescriptive. And sometimes it'd be completely open and I would say, well, I think it has a feeling of an empty house, or I think it has a feeling of a children's playground after the children have gone home, but that's a feeling, it's not a visual note. And I was just see what visual world the collaborators come back with and build on each other. You know, it's a process of each one bringing an idea and the other building on it.
This makes me think, do you ever doubt? I mean, you start and then you move along and then you have to be sure that, first of all, that your vision is not changing along the process, or maybe you will adapt it. But the frame should stay somehow the same because you cannot change everything. How do you work along with, I mean, I suppose you have some doubt or some worries, or tell me more.
No, I never have any worries or any doubts. Everything is fine. Yes, of course, I doubt all the time, every moment, especially at 4 o'clock in the morning. I suppose, on a very pragmatic level, what you don't want and what does happen to all of us, and I've seen it happen many times to many directors, is that you get very, very far along to the point where things are actually built. And then you go, no, this is all wrong. Throw it away. But on the other hand, that could be a very brave decision and might lead you to something richer. But God almighty. Yeah, no, I do doubt all the time. But
I mean, I suppose also this comes with experience. So I guess at first the doubt is bigger than you, but I suppose, yeah, with experience you learn how to trust yourself and just stay on the path.
I think the first time I ever directed an opera, which was a new commission that a friend of mine had written, and I had these ideas, I had these visual ideas, and I really had no idea whether it was going to work. And when it did work, it was a great relief. And so, yes, I mean, you have to think, oh, I remember I felt this way before, and it worked out okay. But actually, it's not as big a problem if you can find the kernel of your vision and the thing that you know you want to always come back to. And you can use that as a guiding principle. And it might have three words, for example. You might say, I want it to feel pathos, or I want to feel, you might have whatever word it is, and you can always relate your ideas back to that. Then you kind of know you're on the right track. And if the ideas you're having give you the feeling that you want to give the audience, then you're sort of on that track and you kind of just keep going on the track. And then you've got your collaborators and you support each other and you say, oh, I'm doubting this. And the other person says, yeah, I don't think that's really working. Let's change it, or let's work on it, or let's think about it some more. Or they say, no, that's really working well. Let's not fiddle with that bit. You know, you work together. You work together. But yeah, I mean, it is always terrifying. And the most terrifying moment is when the curtain goes up in front of the first audience and you think, oh my God, is this going to be a terrible disaster? That's
I'm glad
very
you think that. Do you think that every time, or yes,
yes,
okay,
of
good.
course. It's terrible, terrible feeling, a terrible feeling.
What motivated you to establish Cambridge City Opera?
Well, I moved to Cambridge some time ago because my husband is here, and I just had it in my head, you know, at some point I'm going to want to work closer to home. And also, Cambridge is very rich with stories. There's a lot of stories here. There are a lot of museums attached to the university, and they have some very, well, they have endless, endless stories. And I thought, well, I could work with other artists to make original pieces of music theatre inspired by some of these stories that we find locally. Now, when I say locally, I don't know, it sounds really limiting because they're not really local stories. They're sort of universal stories. But yeah, that was sort of my thinking. And actually, it's been very rewarding. It's been quiet in the recent years because I've been busy with other things. But the principle of I'm still following the principle of doing this kind of work because it's very rewarding to find a story. So, for example, the Barrington Hippo, right?
Yeah.
There's a town called Barrington near Cambridge, and at the turn of the 20th century, a team of geologists found a fossilized hippo in Barrington. And this hippo you can see in the museum in Cambridge. And so I made this beautiful little short piece of music theatre for children about the Barrington Hippo. And it was all about geological time and the process of becoming a fossil, and also about these big fauna and how they moved from Africa through Europe across the land bridge to Britain, changing sea levels. And it was very poetic and very beautiful and very rewarding. So that type of thing is really exciting to me, and I love doing it.
When collaborating with composers or developing new works, because you've mentioned the Barrington Hippo and London Burned or On the Axis of This World, how do you ensure your vision aligns with theirs while staying true to the story?
I think this is a really good question and really interesting question because it presents a duality between the composer and the musicians on one hand and the director on the other. And that is often the way people see the world. They see the world, oh, the director is somehow in opposition to the composer or the conductor. And that hasn't really been my experience because you're sort of collaborating, trying to do the same thing, which is tell a story through music and actor. And certainly in working with the composers that I've worked with, and I've done a lot of new work now, and I find it really exciting and I love doing it. I mean, you're trying to do the same thing, right? You're not in opposition. So I suppose it could happen that your vision would not align, but really if you're working together, your vision does align. And that's been what's so exciting about it. So for example, the very first time I did this, which was The Raven with the composer Matt Rogers, he and I cooked up this idea to make an adaptation of the Edgar Allan Poe poem, The Raven. The first conversation we had, we talked about the feeling that the poem gave us, what sort of feeling it gave us. And then we went through the poem and we picked out 12 or 13 lines. It's a very long poem, a lot and lot of lines, but we picked out 12 or 13 lines that gave us that feeling. And we said, well, that will be our piece. We'll use those lines and each one will be a scene. And then Matt went away and wrote the music. And again, you know, what a terrifying thing, because what if I didn't like the music? Like, it wasn't really difficult. And I was really scared that when I heard it, I wouldn't have any creative response to it. Wouldn't have any ideas. But of course, that's not what happened. I heard the music and it was just the most incredible experience because it was this musical encapsulation of the feelings that we had talked about together. It was the most utterly stimulating, exciting, creatively rich experience. And that has been more commonly the case for me, that actually the resonance between, if you've got the right collaborator, the resonance between you is such that, I mean, it's one, not that it's one vision, but it's two visions working together very closely.
And if the energy is aligned, then something amazing can come out.
Yeah.
This brings me to the next question, Sinead. Where do you find inspiration?
Well, I'd love to find some inspiration on a January morning. I'd love to find some inspiration. I mean, goodness, where do you find inspiration? Okay, to take it seriously, I think there are two parts to this question. I think one part is about how do you find the inspiration to actually continue working in this world, which is the world of the arts. Right? Why? how and why do you find inspiration to do that? Because I think, I don't know what it's like where you are. I imagine that it's much richer in Vienna in terms of support for the arts, but certainly in Britain, there's a culture at the moment that is very against, I think, the arts, and particularly theater. And so you have to find some inspiration to find value in what you do, because you're being told all the time that it doesn't really have much value. And then the other part of the question is to find inspiration for a particular production. So in the first part, I think it's about turning to other people who've done it, like going to your concert in the National Gallery. That was very inspiring.
Thank you.
You know, finding people who say it is valuable to spend time doing this stuff. And that could be a friend like you who's playing the piano and just opening up worlds of beauty and communication. Or it could be a book. I mean, I have to say I'm going to turn to James Joyce, because doubt, that's where I go. Really, if I feel doubt, I will go to James Joyce, because just that richness of imagination and the strangeness and the depth, and yeah, so finding other artists that can be
Bring
encouraging.
it back.
Yeah. And then the second part of the question is about finding inspiration for a particular production, and then that can be anything. And really, it's not about where do you find inspiration. It's more about can you make yourself open to the inspiration when it lands, because you could find it anywhere. It could be certainly going to a gallery or going to a concert, but it could also just be walking down the street and seeing two people interacting, for example.
Yeah, but I find this fascinating because, as an artist, as you yourself are, you have to be so authentic and really, it's like going a bit spiritual, but like really having all your chakras open to absorb anything, everything which might come to you. It can be your children or just a vision, just a picture, a photograph, anything which could bring you to the next level on your artistic vision.
Yeah, I think what you're putting your finger on is something about noticing, being available to notice the things that are happening around you and the things that are happening to you. And that idea of noticing, I think, is very important also for an audience, and that's what I would be trying to allow an audience to do, is that you've got this 2 hours or this hour or whatever it is where you're sitting here. Notice. Just notice. That's sort of what it's all about, I think, for me.
Sinead, has becoming a mother influenced your artistic choices and your approach to directing?
I turn to you. It's too soon. So my children are 1 and 3. I hope that it has, but I'm really just trying to get through the next 5 minutes. Mean, I brought my notebook to show you. Again, it won't work really well on radio, but I have this notebook here, and it just has random things in it that I could do, like sticking in a picture from a magazine or writing down three lists of words. It's just lists of words because when I had my little girl who's a year old, so over the last year, it's a really, as you know, goodness, how could you even talk about it? It's a deep, rich time. But you don't have any spare time to reflect on that. You don't want to lose that intense, creative, extraordinary experience. I didn't want it to be gone and I wouldn't have noticed it. But at the same time, I didn't have time to reflect on it. So I just wrote down lists of words that would come into my head, and it was great fun. I recommend it to anybody. They can be anything. Broccoli, window frame, toilet, nap, any word. You don't have any judgment. You just put down whatever word you want, and it's so much fun. It's really good fun. So that's what I've been doing. So that's the extent so far of the influence on
Yeah,
my.
but I find this very good and very smart, because not only you put that words which did they come to you, or pictures or stickers or whatever, but then when you come back in time when things have changed, because they will change and they are changing constantly, you'll still feel what you felt when you wrote that word, or when you put that sticker or whatever, and it will bring back the emotion you had in that moment, and I think that's very rich.
So, I hope so. Did you do anything like that?
No.
you
I
tell
had
me.
no podcast before to listen to yours.
So you tell me then, what's the answer to the question? What's been the influence on you of your children?
Well, maybe I didn't put them down, but I have some like some drawers in my mind, and I put emotions. And for example, putting my children to bed, and or that feeling when they're already asleep and you hear them just breathing. That feeling brings so much emotion in me that the next time I play a Mozart concerto, I will think about that one in the second movement, and I will just be there. And this brings a lot of emotion, and all these little drawers, when I open them up, filled with well, when they're in connection with my family, my children, they're very, very rich in different directions. And I think using them and allowing them to be there, it's something very special.
Did you, at the time when they were very, very tiny and it's so demanding, you were yet playing very serious major concerts?
When my daughter was born, she was born in June, and in August I had my first concert in Chicago at the Zrafinia Festival. But
Did
that's
you go
big.
with you? Did you take
I
her with
took her
you?
with her. Yeah, with me, because I was, I had to feed her, so she was with me, and I could not even think of letting her home. That was not an option. So yeah, the three of us with my husband, we flew to Chicago. We came back, and then I had another concert in Canada where they also came with me. But because I knew all this will happen, it was already on the schedule. I was very prepared, and this was something natural and normal. And I think it was a very enriching time to know that I did it, we did it, and we managed. And yeah, my performances were like they were on that very moment as being a very brand new mom.
That must have been so inspiring and reassuring and exciting that everything had changed, and yet you were still the artist you knew you could be.
Although I don't think I was the same, because I think we changed completely when we become a mom. At least I felt that, things have changed. My approach has changed. My sound has changed, because that's my identity, which has become a different one. And I think it's yeah, it was a new lifetime.
Incredible. That's such a eloquent way of expressing what a rich experience it is to give birth to actually a new self at the same time as giving birth.
Yeah, exactly. As a mother of two young children, how do you manage the complexities of balancing your demanding career with motherhood? One of my most loved questions.
Goodness me, if I had the solution to that. I mean, but joking aside, one of my great skills, and it's also one of my weaknesses, is that I am an inveterate planner. I just can't help myself. I lie in bed planning detail. And that's great in the context of motherhood because, it means that the nappy bag is always well stocked. And, those little tiny detail things are always taken care of because I spend my time obsessing over them to the detriment, probably, of thinking of things I should be thinking about. So planning, I think just planning. I just spend a lot of time planning. And also, there's an army of people that enable, starting with my husband, who has great flexibility and ability to sort of support me to do what I want to do. I think he's more committed to my career than I am. And starting with him, but also a lot of other people, it takes a lot of people. So I did a show in Dublin. When my son was my first child, who was my son, was a year old, and I had already done a show. We did a show in Wexford when he was 10 months old. So then we were doing this show in Dublin. We'd rented an apartment in Dublin, and I had childcare plans in place. And then 1 week, all the childcare plans fell apart, and he had five different people in five different places looking after him for the 5 days of rehearsals. So, there was an auntie, there was a brother, there was a friend, there was a granddad, all these people were brought into play. And that's how it had to be. So for me, it was great because I was in rehearsal having a lovely time, brilliant, absorbed, interested, and working with these great students in Dublin. And Fiacre, my son, was absolutely fine because he was with having a lot of fun with all these other people. But there were a lot of other people involved, and I just don't think you can do it without that degree of a community who are prepared to drop everything and help you. Just, and even then, it's sort of on the edge all the time. And I'm about to go into rehearsals now, and I'm just lying awake at night going, "How is this going to work?" I just it's not straightforward. What I can say is that when I am in the rehearsal room, having done all the planning for the childcare and the planning for the rehearsal, I really
Even everything falls apart. Yes,
I really
then.
enjoy it, and I find it so absorbing to be working with people, and they're singing and they're moving around, and it's just great fun. I love it.
You can totally switch off.
I can totally forget about my children. Am I allowed to say that?
Maybe I'll edit it for later years.
I think, you know, that must be a sign that, or at least it's certainly a motivating factor to continue doing it. Because of course, a lot of the time I'm going, "Well, this is crazy. I mean, like, even it's just too ambitious to try and do anything." But that's because they're very small, you know, they're very small.
So, what specific challenges do mothers face in the performing arts industry, and what changes would you like to see to make the field more inclusive? We have an hour.
Yeah, I mean, I just think this is such a big question. I think opera houses should have a nappy changing facility in the loos, because I've never found one. That's a big one. You're there with your baby. You say, "Oh, I'll just go and change their nappy." There is nowhere to do it. Do you put them on the floor or the toilet? I mean, some of these buildings are big buildings. They're well designed. They've got everything. They don't have anywhere to change a nappy.
I don't even think in concert halls. I mean, concert halls are not designed for having babies. But still, is there a place to do that? No, I don't think so.
That's kind of extraordinary. And I think that that is a really interesting headline, right? What does that say? It says, "Don't come in here with a baby." That's what it says. And, you know, that's for the people on the front side, front of the house. The audience are coming in front of house, but it's the same message for the artists or the people working in the back of house. Don't come in here with a child. And I have experienced that. You know, I've been, when I was started, I haven't done many contracts with my two little ones. But there is a degree of hostility if you arrive pushing a pram. People don't, some people, of course, some people are lovely, and of course, many people will try to help. But overall, as an industry, there's a degree of hostility. And, you know, when I hear you speaking about the enriching effect on your artistry of becoming a mother, that's the talk we should be having. That actually the people who have gone through this process of becoming mothers have something to offer, a very deep, rich artistry to offer, right? What's
Yeah, I'm
been your
afraid.
experience?
No, I'm afraid that that's not the. I think we still need some time, maybe some generations to this to pass on, because my experience is totally different. On the contrary, mothers are not allowed to speak in this field because, or to talk about the fact that they're actually mothers, because this would have meant that their priorities have changed. And so performing or music or whatever you're doing, it's not that important anymore after becoming a mother. This is a problem when you're dealing with promoters or intendants or who are usually men, and they see that as really, I've experienced this quite frankly after a concert when my daughter was very young and she was in the green room waiting for me after the concert. And after a really successful concert, I've been told, listen, we're not inviting you back because you have a very small child and you need to take care of her maybe in a couple of years when she's older. And the fact is, he kept his word.
Arrogance of it.
And, I was so shocked that I have not, I just. Like I didn't reply anything. I was just I was lost for words.
And did that then affect the way you behaved towards promoters in future?
Exactly. From that moment in time, I was not saying anymore that I'm a mother. I was particularly a young mother, because all that would mean, oh, so you haven't slept in months. So your focus is not there anymore. So let's wait a bit. Or I think things have changed in the meantime. But my agent was telling me, don't show up when you're pregnant, because that conductor will see you and it would mean you're not available in the next couple of months or years or whatever your decision is. So let's keep that secret. So this is terrifying.
So you've been hiding to some extent.
To some extent, yes, with my first pregnancy, yes.
I think it also betrays a lack of understanding of what you've been talking about so beautifully, and how much there is to, how magical and powerful, and the strengthening of somebody's artistic personality that could be being a mother, if the right support is in place. I mean, I think it all also depends on having that support.
Could you share insights or standout experiences from your career so far? What was something you're incredibly proud of?
Yes, I could. I can give you two things I was incredibly proud
more,
of.
As many
obviously,
as more.
There's a huge range. But I think, you know, continuing our conversation about work for children, the Barrington Hippo was really very rewarding, because when I saw the audience responding to it, it was an audience of children, we performed for children. And it was quite, you know, it was really poetic. It wasn't like your usual children's story. It dealt with geological time, it dealt with extinction, it dealt with life and death and birth, but in a very beautiful, poetic way. And I worked with these gorgeous artists who made some very beautiful imagery that was drawn in sand. It was like cave paintings and it was gorgeous. Anyway, the final image of the piece, we did it in a lecture theatre, so there were white walls, and the final image, we had a light bulb and then a blue painted cylinder that the puppeteer brought up over the light bulb, with the effect that the white walls became blue. So the white walls, it looked like the seas were rising over you, basically.
Mm.
And when we were sitting and the seas were rising up over us, there was a little girl beside me who was about four, and she started swimming. She didn't say anything. She just started swimming gestures with her hands and looking at these blue walls. And I thought, that's worked. And I found that so magical, to see her face and to see in her face that she was imagining what I was imagining, which was the sea rising up over us. I just found that glorious. So that's on the very small scale. And then the other piece, and the other one I want to share with you, is on the very large scale, which was when I did a prom at the Royal Albert Hall, and it was a Glyndebourne production of The Barber of Seville. So it was originally directed by Annabel Arden, and it was my role as the assistant director at that time to recreate that staging for the Royal Albert Hall. And we arrived in the hall in the morning. We had one rehearsal with orchestra, and the performers were going to be on the stage in front of the orchestra and behind them. And we used a lot of the organ area. And anyway, we had to kind of do it very quickly, is what I'm saying. We'd one rehearsal with the orchestra. Then we had 3 hours to do some lighting, and then the audience arrived. Thousands of them. I mean, you know what the audience,
yes.
What, is it 4,000 or is it 6,000? I mean, who cares at that stage, right?
Doesn't matter anymore, yeah.
And so it was very fast, and we arrived in the hall in the morning, and I mean, it was just so exciting. It was so exciting. And then we did this rehearsal really quickly, where I was saying, okay, and then you go here and you go there, and do you want to try going up here, and do you want to try making a balcony, and you can give the flower to the orchestra. And we did loads of fun stuff, but we did it really fast. No chance.
We never was only hearing about it.
I know. And we didn't have a chance to practice any of it, right? We just threw it out there, proposal, accept or reject the proposal, and let's go. And then the audience arrived and they laughed their heads off. I mean, 4,000 people laughing their heads off. It was joyous. So that was really so exciting. And I suppose what they both have in common is this audience response. You know, if you can see that the audience is responding in the way you hoped they would, that is amazingly exciting and rewarding. Mm.
The energy exchange, I think, is the most important and amazing one, which could never be expressed in words. It's
and
just
for
there.
You, I mean, you're playing the piano. What does that feel like? Because that nobody is standing up and saying, I feel like this, or how?
No, but you feel, you really feel. If you feel you're touching the audiences, there is an energy exchange. And if you're not having that, you feel that too. And then there is a lot of thinking while playing, what can I do to get them? And then there's some spark which might come or not, and then you have them or not. Every time it's a, you never know what will happen. But when it happens, it's incredibly inspiring and special, and you will always remember that feeling.
It's very motivating, isn't it? I mean, it's a sort of that's why you want to do it again.
Yeah, and for me, that's the most important thing. It's not about perfection, or of course you have a professional level which you have to keep, but the most important thing is for me, if I touched them emotionally or if I felt they came with me. If I felt this didn't happen, then I doubt.
But I've been in a couple of your concerts and it's always been very exciting. And there's always been a huge connection with the audience. I mean, really. So it does it, maybe it doesn't often happen that you don't feel that connection.
Oh, I do feel it. I do feel, and sometimes I feel it was my fault. I didn't, I haven't given enough, or my level of connection was not there because many other things happened in the background, which we as artists, know. I mean, the audience never knows. So there can be some lots of problems or whatever is happening in your or in my life. And then sometimes they can affect your focus or your level of energy. And then, yeah, sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. But I think the challenges or the most exciting thing is that you never know what will happen.
I mean, I think that's why we're not making, we're not making movies or essays or something. It's a very live, it's live, isn't it? The liveness is important.
Yeah, and I think you will need this adrenaline of not knowing what's happening. And that's why we strive for the next one. And the next one will be different. And then it is always different. Sinead, we've come to the last question. And I'd love to know if you would mind sharing your biggest dream for 2025 and beyond. We are at the beginning of January, so it's a good time to ask you this.
Goodness me, as I said to you earlier, I'm really just looking at the next 5 minutes and hoping that I can get through the next 5 minutes okay. So it's a little bit difficult for me to extend my period of hope all the way to the end of the year. My year, I'm directing a big show at Glyndebourne that we go next week to start, and it's a really interesting one. It's a community opera called Uprising by Jonathan Dove, and it's got a lot of people in it. So it's got a community chorus, 50 teenagers and 50 adults. And I've met them, I've worked with them a little bit already, and I find them very inspiring. So I'm really hoping, and I think it will be the case, that working with them for the next couple of months is going to be very inspiring for me personally. I hope for them as well. So I have a big hope, which is I hope that show is going to be okay. I hope it's going to go well. And then after that, I'm giving myself a period of time to reflect a little bit on what the future might hold and to think about what my artistic output might look like in over the next few years. So I'm going to be spending a little bit of time reflecting and thinking and dreaming and planning, and I hope that that will be a rich period. I hope I get some sleep. Trying to be pragmatic about it. But yeah, I think it's going to be a period of time of sort of thinking about what might be next. I hope that some collaboration with you will be a part of that conversation.
I'm sure something will happen. I wish you all the very best and that you get the inspiration, the energy, the sleep, and the time you need. And I hope I can watch a production of yours sooner than later.
Thank you. What a pleasure to talk to you this morning.
And that brings us to the end of today's episode of the Pianofortissimo podcast. I hope you enjoyed this fascinating conversation with Sinead O'Neill and gained insight into her incredible work and creative vision. Thank you for tuning in, and if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss out on future conversations with extraordinary guests. You can also follow the Pianofortissimo podcast on all social media platforms, where I share updates, behind-the-scenes content, and highlights from my episodes. If you'd like to connect with me, Alexandra Silota, you'll find me also everywhere. Until next time, stay inspired, stay curious, and keep celebrating the beauty of music and creativity. See you soon. Thanks for listening. This was Alexandra Silota from Pianofortissimo. Don't forget to subscribe, share with fellow music enthusiasts, follow us on your favorite social media, and most importantly, worry less and let the music flow.